Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 24. Feeling flushed with success after collecting so much data that seemed to incriminate Douglas DeWitt and his dog, I returned home and called Nick Cooper to officially launch my investigation of the Winthrop's retriever, an activity I now considered a mere formality. I told the trainer many shameful but complimentary lies about DeWitt and the Rottweiler to soften him up. Having dispensed with the social amenities, I broached the subject of Hal Winthrop. "What a piece of work that guy is," the trainer snorted. "Talk about blowing hot and cold." "I take it he didn't do any better than Jeff Weintraub?" I tactfully prompted him. "Two completely different personalities," Cooper declared emphatically. "Jeff's a fear-biter, like his dog. Hal Winthrop's inconsistent as hell, but his dog's got some solid stuff behind him." "Come to think of it, though," he chuckled, "maybe they're kind of alike, too." "You think Jason could make Schutzhund grade?" I asked the question more out of politeness than because I believed this represented a viable possibility. "I'd give him a 60-40 chance," came the unanticipated reply. "That much?" I found that hard to believe, given the memory of the drooling lummox pinning me to the ground. "Once you get his attention, he settles down real fast," the trainer explained. "When I first worked with him and Hal, I was pretty impressed. But Hal couldn't stay focused. Soon as Jason had do something once, Hal wanted to try something new rather than nail down that skill." "So that was the end of Jason's training?" "No," came another surprising reply. "I guess Hal originally got the dog for his wife, so when he lost interest, he asked me to give her some private lessons. There's no real bond between her and the animal, but she's determined to make something of him." "She's still a client of yours." I became more attentive when the subject of Jason's continued training came up. "Taking the summer off." Nick Cooper's voice carried a trace of envy. "Guess they spend a lot of time at their second home, but Pamela, Hal's wife, promised to work Jason on her own and get Hal's help, too. Don't know that having Hal's help will contribute much, though. Seems to me it could confuse the hell out of the dog." I agreed that a person like Hal Winthrop could be detrimental to any dog's mental health, thanked Cooper for his input, and hung up. "Well, quadrupeds, what do you say we do some grocery shopping?" I suggested to the pets, who immediately rushed to the door. "We need yet another plan to investigate our final suspect, and I haven't a clue. Perhaps a change of scenery will help." Once in the area's only supermarket, my thoughts about the case unaccountably led me to the produce counter, where I picked up a bag of mixed nuts and a melon. Considering these two items rarely show up in my grocery cart, I suspected they carried some subliminal meaning I didn't want to know about. By the time I came out of the store and loaded my purchases into the trunk of my car, I still didn't have any plan. But I did have enough food to last me for weeks. "Maybe Joe'll give me some ideas," I next proposed to the pets, who happily ignored me as I took in all the sights, scents, and sounds as I drove down the highway. The emptiness in the post office led me to make the conditioned response when I arrived. "Pretty quiet, isn't it?" "Yep," the old postmaster grinned. "A lot of folks gone or thinking about going." "That include the lake people?" I zeroed in on my main topic of interest. "Guess that Weintraub fella's heading out, and I say good riddance. Sure had me fooled." Joe Talbot's expression made it crystal clear that he didn't appreciate being fooled one bit. "And that young fellow at the Newcombs told JJ he'd be gone by the end of the week, too." "You have new people coming into your place?" I asked, so I wouldn't appear too curious about the other residents. "First of the week," Joe cheerfully reported. Nice family with two youngins and no dogs. After talking about Joe's new renters and then Eleanor for a while, I steered the conversation back to my suspects. What about the Winthrops? I asked to complete my list. They still around? Hell, they went back to Massachusetts soon as you found that goat. His eyes glittered mischievously. Young Harold was right flustered when I told him you's the one that found it, for it even showed up in the newspaper. That was the first time it dawned on me that it probably did show up in the paper. I even could imagine the headline, Local Vet Finds Valuable Goat. So how did you find out about it before it hit the paper? I asked Joe the question I knew he was dying to answer. One of the troopers working on the case just moved into town and got a box here, he announced. I stifled the urge to ask if it was Trooper Igor, not particularly wanting to know if the formidable civil servant and I now shared the same zip code. Instead, I bought yet another sheet of stamps and returned to my car. Here's the problem, I informed the pets once we were on the road again. I have three suspects, and two of them will be gone by the end of the week, and the third has already flown the coop. How can I prove who murdered Monica if I don't have any suspects? Maddie gave me a contemplative look I decided meant he agreed with me. Teresa's enthusiastic tail-thumping didn't exactly compliment the gravity of the situation, but I thanked her for her support anyhow. Elizabeth stretched out on the back window ledge and snoozed through the entire exchange. Whenever I find life dissatisfying for any reason, I always seek solace in my gardens. On that particular day, I edged all the flower beds in the area immediately surrounding the house, then transplanted some wildly proliferating daisies on the slope beside it. During this time, I convinced myself it would be both ludicrous and dangerous to pursue my three suspects into their home territories in Massachusetts. That astute observation gave rise to two more, equally sagacious revelations. That means that if I don't wrap this baby up in the next 3 days, I informed the pets as I put my tools in the garden cart, I have to learn anything else I need to know about two suspects and practically everything about Jason Winthrop indirectly. How I could possibly accomplish such an investigation occupied my thoughts as I put the cart in the shed and walked to the house. Time and time again, I returned to something Jim Godfrey had taught me. What can I learn from any piece of evidence in and of itself, and what can I learn from comparing it to something else? I murmured the premise aloud as I washed up at the kitchen sink. If I hadn't been such a coward, maybe I could have found evidence of the other dog when I was in the cottage the day after Monica died. I berated myself while Maddie leaned over from his perch in the bay window above the sink to watch me lather my hands. I distractedly looked down at the floor when some water splashed out of the sink and immediately noticed the bits of plant matter and dirt on the braided rug that the pets had dragged in. I sighed and cursed myself for being such a conscientious housekeeper. "It'll serve you right when Mommy Dearest gets out the vacuum cleaner to clean up your mess," I warned the animals, knowing how much they all despised the noisy appliance. Elizabeth and Maddie looked at me in horror, while Teresa beat a hasty retreat under the table. I laughed at their reactions and wondered if I could clean up the debris some other, quieter way. My musings over this common housekeeping chore led my mind to leapfrog from pets to vacuum cleaners to dirty rugs to cleaning them with the most amazing results. "That's it!" I screeched with such enthusiasm, Maddie lost his balance and fell into the sink. "Yes, yes, frozen yogurt and cookies for everyone tonight," I sang happily as I dried my hands, plucked the cat out of the sink, and dropped him to the floor, where he vigorously shook the water off each foot as if it were a flesh-eating bacteria. Then I practically skipped down the basement stairs and reverently picked up the plastic bag containing the rug that Joe Talbot had dropped off at the cottage the day Monica Sonko died. Still humming gaily, I charged back up the stairs, removed everything from the kitchen table, and thoroughly cleaned it. Once satisfied that nary a speck of debris marred its surface, I thoroughly cleaned my best brush and placed it on the table. Then I removed the rug from the bag, carefully spread it out on the clean table, and systematically groomed every inch of Eleanor Talbot's handiwork until I'd collected a sizable pile of debris. This I then put in the large envelope I'd brought down from the office specifically for that purpose. After carefully folding the rug and replacing it in the bag for safekeeping, I located an old magnifying glass and a pair of forceps left over from my medical days and put them and a large piece of white paper on the table. Finally, I sat down at the table and carefully plucked a small amount of debris from the envelope with the forceps and examined it with the lens. By the time it had grown dark, I'd separated the original pile into two smaller ones, one of cotton threads and other debris, and a second of hair. Then I sorted the pile of hair by color, length, and texture as best I could with my lens, a tedious process that took several hours more. "Very interesting," I announced to my grossly disinterested pets. "It looks like we have four different kinds of hair, but I need something with higher magnification to tell me for sure." I put my collections in separate envelopes and looked at the clock. It was too late to go to Tony's now, but first thing tomorrow morning. "Great job with the goat," Tony hailed me when I entered his clinic the next day. "Did you get some fabulous reward you can split with me for donating my facilities to such a worthy cause?" "All the goat DNA I can eat," I laughed at his enthusiastic greeting. "Now may I borrow your fabulous facilities for another worthy cause?" "You know the way," he grinned, "but I hope this one pays better." Once in the lab, I examined my samples microscopically and laboriously confirmed what my preliminary crude studies had strongly suggested. All the hairs I found on the rug were either Monica's long, pale blonde ones, Harley's short white or fawn-colored ones, or medium-length golden ones. There wasn't a black or red or mahogany brown hair in the lot. Who would have thunk? I leaned back in the chair and stared at the ceiling, trying to assemble all I knew about Jason Winthrop into something that made sense. But every time I tried to make a case for him being a killer, the image of him standing over me with that silly grin on his face aborted the process. In desperation, I switched my focus from the animal to his owner. Did Hal Winthrop have a good reason to sic his dog on Monica Sonko, or to cover up the crime if the dog attacked her on his own? I couldn't imagine him commanding his dog to attack Monica, but I could easily imagine him covering up the crime if the dog attacked her on his own for some reason. If Harold Sr. was restructuring the company in hopes of eliminating any dead wood, that would seem to put one particular chip off the old block in a vulnerable position from the start, a possibility Hal's questions about my self-employment would seem to support. If Hal proved so inept he somehow additionally managed to convert a happy-go-lucky golden retriever into a homicidal maniac, I could easily imagine his father giving him the corporate heave-ho. That would explain his comments about unforgiving families and paying for one dumb mistake for the rest of your life. But for as valid as Hal's arrival after the fact sounded, it, too, suffered from a tragic flaw. That would mean Monica put Harley in the bedroom before she let Jason in, because I can tell you for sure that Golden didn't have a wound on him, I informed the ceiling. I still can't see her doing that. I just opened my mouth to elaborate on this point when I noticed one of Tony's techs peering at me curiously. Evidently, she had entered the lab while I immersed myself in my mental dialogue, and I hadn't even seen her. Before the blush of embarrassment completely engulfed me, I hastily scooped up my envelopes of evidence and departed as quickly as professional decorum allowed. As I drove down the narrow winding road between Tony's clinic and my home, I made several more futile attempts to understand how and why Jason killed Monica Sonko, all grossly distorted by the memory of the dog standing over me. But once I got past that image, I recalled other incriminating canine behaviors. The way Jason leaned against Hal and nosed Pamela for attention. His intermittent response to commands. All dominant gestures, easily dismissed as innocent signs of affection in a well-behaved animal, but foretelling disaster in a poorly trained one. Especially when only half-trained to attack of his own accord. What difference does it make? I pounded the steering wheel in frustration. The Winthrops are gone, so there's no way I can prove it. The depression that reminder initially precipitated almost instantly gave way to jubilation. I'd have Journey's End to myself. With the Winthrops and Jason out of the picture, I could safely break in and collect some dog hairs to send to Jim, along with some from the rug, to see if they matched. If they did, I'd have concrete proof that Jason was in that cottage the day Monica died. As soon as I arrived home, I rummaged through numerous drawers until I found another penlight, which I put in my back pocket with an assortment of plastic bags, a small clean brush, and, recalling McCarthy's tirade after my breaking and entering escapade at Jeff Weintraub's cottage, a pair of gloves so I wouldn't leave any fingerprints. I then retreated to the basement for another set of breaking and entering tools to replace those I'd lost in the lake. Unfortunately, I felt more like Goldilocks than Sherlock Holmes when I peered into the toolbox. Everything in it looked either too big or too little. Nothing looked just the right size. How about this monstrous screwdriver and this itty-bitty pair of pliers? I asked the cat. He gave me a look I decided meant, unless you planned to dismantle the Winthrop's house, I'd leave that screwdriver at home. I agreed and traded it in for one of Bob's razor-sharp wood chisels. Bob would roll over in his grave if he knew I planned to use this as a screwdriver, I chuckled to Maddie, then remembered that Bob had been cremated and added, guess not. I smiled and gave the cat an extra pat before racing up the stairs again. Not great, I admitted to the dogs, as I tried to find a place to put the chisel where it wouldn't lethally impale me every time I moved. But it'll have to do. Feeling almost euphoric about breaking into an absolutely safe, uninhabited house, I left for Journey's End for what I promised the pets would be the very last time. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.